Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point. It started on March 20th, 2020, at the very start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
To confront these public health degrees, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has decided to exercise its authority under the Title 42 of the U.S. Code to give Customs and Border Protection the tools it needs to prevent the transmission of the virus coming through both the northern and the southern borders.
Under Title 42, President Donald Trump essentially closed the U.S. border to all migrants, including asylum seekers. Title 42 is a public health statute that dates all the way back to 1893, when the U.S. wanted to stop the spread of cholera by regulating shipping containers coming into the country. The statute was then revised in 1944, giving the federal government the authority to suspend entries and imports in order to prevent the spread of disease. It has been used very few times and never quite like this before.
You come to the United States and you make your case that I seek asylum based on the following premise, why I deserve it under American law. They're sitting in squalor on the other side of the river.
That was Joe Biden during a presidential debate against Donald Trump back in October 2020. In April 2020, then U.S. Senator and now Vice President Kamala Harris signed a letter to the Trump administration asking them to end the policy, stating, quote, "This amounts to a startling expansion of executive power under the guise of a global pandemic response." So, many people thought when Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won the presidential election in 2020, Title 42 would quickly be lifted.
The Biden administration is keeping a controversial Trump-era policy on migrants intact, which opponents say could put asylum seekers in danger.
And it stayed on the books month after month after month. Even when COVID cases dropped and many restrictions were lifted, Title 42 stayed in place. The reasoning: the CDC said so. Here's White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We don't see Title 42 as an immigration policy. It is a public health authority because we're still in the middle of a pandemic, and it is determined by the CDC.
And here's Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas.
It is not an immigration policy. It is not an immigration policy that we in this administration would embrace. But we view it as a public health imperative, as the Centers for Disease Control has so ordered.
Meanwhile, many in the CDC, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's leading expert on COVID, seem to think expelling migrants isn't a, quote, solution to an outbreak.
I mean, if you just look at the data and look at the people who've gotten infected, look at the people who are in the hospital, look at the people who've died, this is not driven by immigrants. This is the problem within our country, the same way it's a problem with other countries throughout the world. Certainly immigrants can get infected, but they're not the driving force of this. Let's face reality here.
Under the Biden administration, some restrictions have been lifted. Here's White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki again.
There are several exceptions for Title 42, including those who are fleeing persecution, who express a concern of fear.
But whether these exceptions are actually being implemented on the border is hard to say. We spoke to a woman seeking asylum on the southern border. She says exceptions to Title 42 have not been made for her. Maria is from San Pedro Sula in northern Honduras. It's one of the most dangerous cities in the entire world. We're not using Maria's real name since she is in fear of her and her family's lives. Maria left Honduras with her three kids, ages 15, 11, and four, in June of 2021, after a powerful gang member threatened to kill them. Maria does not speak English, so we spoke to her through an interpreter named Martha Areola.
I had already had issues with these people because this lady's brother fell in love with my daughter. She was around 12 years old at that time. And I said to this lady that I was going to accuse him before the police. And she told me that if I did anything against her brother, she was going to have us killed.
Knowing her life was in danger, she packed up her things and fled. She headed for the U.S., where her oldest son lives in California. But she knew the journey wouldn't be easy. She'd have to travel hundreds of miles through places that weren't safe.
When we were in Mexicali, we were detained by some people that were holding us against knives and telling us that we had to pay for a ransom if we wanted to keep going. And my son had to pay for them to let us go.
Finally, they got to the U.S. border in November and tried to seek asylum at the port of entry in Calexico, California. She was held by U.S. immigration officials for 2 days.
They told me they were not going to let me talk. I was trying to speak with them and tell them that I was afraid for our lives, especially my 15-year-old's life, because there they steal the children, they steal the girls. They held me for 2 days with my children, and they gave us just a burrito and some water and threw us without clothes, all dirty, back at Mexico, and my children were crying. They were crying out of hunger.
Maria was dropped off at San Luis Rio, Colorado, in Mexico with her 3 children, 3 hours from where she crossed the border to a place she'd never been before, without any food, water, or even the belongings she arrived with. No shelters in town would take them, so they slept on the sidewalk. Maria was able to get a hold of her son back in the U.S., who gave her money to take a bus to Tijuana, where there were more shelters available. Finally, she was able to find a safe place through a local church, but outside the shelter was a very different story.
And once in the afternoon, I was going for some pizza with my girls, and we saw some men. They had guns. I don't know if they were trying to hijack us or what. I went into the pizza place with my younger daughter. My older daughter could not move, and I kept telling her, they are going to kill you. Come inside, or they are going to kill you. So I went outside again. They were pointing at her stomach and her forehead. And after that, we didn't go out of shelter for a very long time. I am very, very scared to leave the shelter.
Maria has been in Tijuana since November. It has been almost a year since she fled her home. She says she knows she will be killed if she goes back. The only option she has now is to wait. Wait until Title 42 goes away and she can finally seek asylum.
I would say that they should at least give us the opportunity to fight for our children. In our countries, they recruit minors. They recruit the boys and teach them how to kill. And the girls, they take them away from your hands to rape them. I love my children, and I really wish the Title 42 would disappear so that we can fight for a better life.
Earlier this month, the CDC finally lifted Title 42. In a written statement, the director of the CDC, Rochelle Walensky, said this policy is, quote, no longer necessary to protect public health. This hour on Point, how effective was Title 42 as a public health policy, an immigration policy, and more importantly, what were the costs after more than 2 years? To talk about the human impact of this policy, we are joined by Eleanor Acer. She's with the nonprofit Human Rights First, where she works on issues relating to refugee protection, asylum, and migrants' rights. She joins us from New York City. Welcome to On Point.
I'm happy to join you all today.
So we just heard Maria's story. How similar is that to what you've been hearing at your organization?
The story that she described is so typical of the accounts that we hear day in and day out, and that all the groups that work along the border with asylum seekers hear. At Human Rights First, working with other partners, we've now tracked almost 10,000 accounts of kidnappings, torture, rape, and other violent attacks on people who've been blocked or expelled due to the Title 42 policy since President Biden took office last year. And these numbers are just the tip of the iceberg. Sorry.
No, please. So tell me how that has changed, because we know even before Title 42, there were migrants at the southern border in particular. How did Title 42 change the situation there on the ground?
Well, Title 42 was one of a series of policies that the Trump administration initiated. The prior policies, remain in Mexico, and the metering policy, all worked to essentially turn people seeking asylum back to places where they're in danger and to evade refugee law that would allow them to actually seek asylum. What Title 42 did was really turn people back to some of the very same conditions, but without even the sort of theoretical opportunity to seek asylum that had existed under the Remain in Mexico program. But both of the policies are fundamentally flawed, and they're human rights disasters, they're legal disasters, and they're migration management disasters too.
And where are some of these migrants coming from? I mean, there was a pandemic, but there was also a lot of upheaval happening in the world, which caused people to seek asylum at the U.S. border.
Yeah, absolutely. So people who are coming to the U.S. border come from a variety of countries. In the reports that we've issued recently, we've documented cases, for example, of a 29-year-old woman from Venezuela who sought asylum at the U.S. border, but was instead turned away under Title 42. And she was then abducted, threatened at knife point, and raped. In March, a Nicaraguan family of six with two young daughters were kidnapped in Reynosa, an encampment that has grown because of Title 42. A Salvadoran family with 8 and 12-year-old children were kidnapped almost immediately after being expelled in the middle of the night and held captive for 20 days, locked in a storage room by men who repeatedly threatened to rape the mother. You've probably heard as well that refugees from Ukraine have showed up at the U.S. border. But the Biden administration has actually exempted them from Title 42, allowing in refugees from Ukraine while turning away Black and brown asylum seekers at the same time.
Well, Eleanor Acer is director of the Refugee Protection Program at Human Rights First. Thank you so much for joining us. We're discussing this hour the pandemic-driven immigration policy known as Title 42. I'm Kimberly Akinstor. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Today we're talking about the public health statute known as Title 42 that was enacted under President Trump to essentially block migrants from entering the border. It has been in place since the start of the pandemic and is expected to end next month. Here with me now is Monette Zard. She's the director at the Program on Forced Migration and Health at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Monette is joining us from New York City. Welcome to On Point, Monette.
Thanks for having me, Kimberly.
And we're also joined by Harold Koh. He's a former senior advisor in the State Department's legal team under President Biden. Before leaving his post, he wrote an internal memo in October calling the use of Title 42, quote, illegal and, quote, inhumane. Harold is joining us from New Haven. Welcome to On Point, Harold.
Hi, Kimberly.
So to start, I want to talk about Title 42 as a public health policy. Monette, it was enacted at a time, it was the beginning of the pandemic, and we didn't really know how having asylum seekers enter the U.S. could affect us as a mental health policy, as a public health policy. Can you talk about how effective you had hoped the policy would be at the beginning and what has subsequently happened?
Well, I think, the record over the last 2 years certainly shows no evidence that this has been a successful public health policy. And I think its public health basis from the beginning was distinctly tenuous. From its inception in March 2020, it sort of flew in the face of established public health tenets and practiced. It was imposed at a time when we already knew that there was widespread community transmission happening in the US. And, to the extent that border restrictions work at all, they work under only very limited circumstances. And when community transmission is already here, the risk is within our own communities. It's not coming from across the border. I think the other important thing to bear in mind is, the way in which Title 42 was imposed. I mean, viruses don't, distinguish between migration status or nationality. And so, closing the border to this one particular group of migrants and asylum seekers, when there was no evidence at all elucidated to show that they were posing a particular risk, at the same time as thousands, hundreds of or tens of thousands of essential workers were, crossing the border every day, it didn't make sense from a public health perspective. And from early on, I think we saw very little attention being paid to what we knew to be effective public health measures that could be taken with relatively little cost, measures, that are tried and tested to control the spread of communicable diseases like COVID.
So, Monette, your group sent roughly 5 letters to the CDC asking for data and science to justify the policy. What information were you seeking, and what was the response?
The response, unfortunately, was resounding silence. We never received a response to the letters that we wrote, that many public health colleagues and epidemiologists signed on to. I think, the data underpinning the policy itself was never presented. The risk that was ostensibly posed by this particular group was never substantiated. And the kind of tracking and testing that would have been necessary to show whether or not this was even an effective tool was never presented or conducted. So, that kind of ongoing monitoring and evaluation, certainly we haven't seen. But at the same time, I think, the record has shown really this was not a public health measure from the get-go. It flew in the face of, the advice of public health experts, even within the CDC, who at the time questioned the public health basis for the policy, right back in the early days. So silence, unfortunately, and I think it's unlikely that this data will ever be presented.
So, Harold, you were at the State Department in the Biden administration at this time. What were you finding out about this policy? What conversations were happening, and what advice were you giving?
Well, I gave the advice that I gave in the memo that I sent when I left in October, which was, first of all, to call it a Title 42 process is a bit of a misnomer. It's actually a non-process process. The president, during the campaign, had put it well. He said, in the United States, you come to the U.S. and you make your case. That suggests two things. It's an individualized process where you get a chance to make your case for asylum as a person, not as part of a group. So you get a right to a hearing, and you might not win that hearing, but at least you have a right to be heard. And the second is that it's going to be applied in a non-discriminatory fashion, that it doesn't matter what the color of your skin is or where you're from. You get a chance to make a case that you're being denied a right to asylum on the grounds that you might be persecuted on political grounds or because of other asylum factors. What this did was, it was just a blanket way of eliminating this without explanation, and using the fig leaf of a Title 42 explanation, which, as you heard, Dr. Fauci didn't think was legitimate, and he's the person who's been in charge of our public health efforts on the COVID issue. So all we said, and many at the State Department, I think, agreed with me, is you've got to give individualized hearings, and you've got to give them on a non-discriminatory basis. A third particular concern arose with regard to people from Haiti, because we had just granted temporary protected status to people from Haiti on the grounds that the conditions there were so dangerous that people couldn't be returned. After that determination was made, the president of Haiti was assassinated. There were a whole series of humanitarian disasters, an earthquake and a tropical storm. And then you had a situation where the gang violence dramatically surged upwards. So if you're giving people who are from Haiti, who are already in the country, temporary protected status, what's the basis from turning people away on a blanket basis without giving them an individual right to be heard?
So, Harold, you said that, in your opinion, the implementation of Title 42 was illegal. At the top, we did say that in the past, not very frequently, but in the past, it has been used to try to stop the spread of cholera and other infectious diseases. What is it about the implementation of Title 42 in the last 2 years that makes it illegal in a way that the previous uses were acceptable?
Well, first of all, it's being done on a much more blanket basis. Secondly, the Remain in Mexico policy had been struck down by a court, the Ninth Circuit. And then this policy was put in place by the Trump administration right afterwards, doing the same thing, but on a much broader basis. I'm a lawyer, and in the government I was serving as a lawyer, the U.S. government doesn't have any authority to act in a fashion that's inconsistent with the law. And under both statute and treaty, there is no discretion to remove someone when their life or freedom would be threatened to the place where they'd be returned to because of their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So we were clearly violating that. So all I was saying was, look, this is an illegal policy. You can't pursue it. It's also an inhumane policy for all the reasons we've heard already in this program. But the illegal aspect was something that made it an option that shouldn't have been pursued. What ended up happening, as you know, is that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit also looked at it. A very conservative judge appointed by Trump also found that it was illegal. And one of the reasons, I think, driving this change of policy now is that the administration has decided to not appeal that ruling and instead to change the policy, which is what they should have done from the very beginning.
So, Manette, from a public health standpoint, how might have this been handled differently? Should it had not been used at all in a way to address migrants or immigration at all? I'm trying to get to the point where, aside from the fact that I think a very clear argument could be made that this wasn't meant to be a public health policy in the first place, what should have been done on a public health basis at the beginning of the pandemic in order to ensure that there weren't possibly people who were infected with COVID coming into the country?
Well, I think the important thing to bear in mind is, that if Title 42 was used at all, it should have been used on a very limited and exceptional basis. If we go back to that period in March 2020, as we were trying to figure out, what this virus could do, One could make the case that we were still learning about transmission. We were still learning about, you know, how to prevent transmission. But it became very quickly apparent that there were a host of tried and tested public health measures that could be deployed together to mitigate transmission risks. Those are things like ventilation, masking, social distancing, and of course now, you know, rapid testing, vaccines. We have an array of very effective tools that, you know, can be deployed together ideally to prevent, you know, and mitigate the risk of COVID-19 spreading. And, you know, quite early on, we began to use these tools in very effective ways to mitigate spread, you know, in our schools, in our shelters, you know, in other places where people were congregating. And so I think, you know, public health always argues for the least restrictive measures to be used. And it would have been, I think, a supremely reasonable and rational and humane response to pivot very quickly to using those tools and much more effective overall, I think, as a public health approach.
Harold, how much did politics, in your opinion, weigh in on this? You have this policy that was implemented during the Trump administration. It seemed mostly as an immigration policy, more so than a public health one, but then a reluctance to end it in the Biden administration. Do you think that it would have been fear of the political blowback that led it, that made it take more than a year for the Biden administration to make a change?
I'm not a politician. I don't know what they were thinking. I do know that when the Afghanistan crisis occurred, there was a sense of loss of control and chaos. The irony, of course, was we were welcoming to Afghan refugees, but at the same time, we were not welcoming this group of refugees. And we were also not, in contrast also to how we're now treating Ukraine refugees. So the discrimination groups became more pronounced. But I want to flag two particularly shocking kinds of returns or expulsions that occurred under this policy. One was that at the border, if an individual, group, or family appeared, they had an exemption policy where the children would be allowed to come forward. But they also decided to not vaccinate people for fear that people would be coming to get vaccines. So you would have cases where parents would have to decide at the border to let their children separate from them so that the children could enter and have a shot at a better life while they're stuck. And so this was implementing a policy of de facto coerced family separation. The other kind of behavior was this expulsion flights. They would just get a whole group of people and put them on an airplane and send them back to the one place that they should not be asked to go, which is a place that they're fleeing from. For example, put Haitians on a plane to Haiti, but they wouldn't tell them where they're going. So people would be on the plane and they'd be saying, where are we going? And they wouldn't be told. And then they would land and they'd be told, you've been taken back to the country that you're fleeing from. That's the exact act of return, or what's called in the treaty refoulement, that's forbidden by both the Refugee Convention and the Torture Convention. So they asked that there be something called a shout test, where people at least be told, you're going to Haiti. Does anybody want to get off the plane and seek asylum? But they didn't do that. So that's the kind of thing which, if applied around the world by other countries, could lead to extraordinary results and the effective nullification of individuals' right to asylum.
Monette, we're going to talk more about what policies should be in place and what we've learned about this, but I want to sort of start that now from a public health point of view. As lawmakers look at ways to change policy. What do you think they should keep front of mind as a lesson from this to impose policies so that you don't see this sort of human rights disaster taking place at the border?
So I think, you know, there are two things to really keep front and center. One is we have tried and tested public health tools that can be deployed to enable, you know, the process of seeking asylum to take place safely sort of effectively. I think that's a critical thing to bear in mind. We're not reinventing the wheel. We have the tools. And I think secondly, as we've heard already so eloquently, you know, to bear in mind the harms that are being caused by refusing to apply these public health tools. I mean, in the name of public health, we have been sending people back to situations of extreme violence. We've been sending people back to places where there are risks to their lives, where deaths have resulted. We've seen a whole catalog of inhumanity result from the application of this tool. And, you know, in everything that we do in public health, we need to be driven by the science, and we need to be proportionate in how we're managing risks. And I think, you know, both the science is telling us that we have the tools, and the evidence is showing us that Title 42 is resulting in extreme harm to individuals, and certainly harm that in no way can be justified using public health.
All right, we're going to have our guests hold for a moment. We're discussing this hour the pandemic-driven immigration policy known as Title 42, and that is set to expire next month. More after the break. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking about the public health statute known as Title 42 that was enacted under Trump to essentially block migrants from entering the border. It's been in place since the start of the pandemic and is expected to end next month. Our guests are Harold Koh, formerly of the State Department, and also Monette Saar, Director of the Program on Forced Migration and Health at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. And we're now joined by Aaron Reichlin-Melnick. He's a senior policy counsel at the American Immigration Council. He testified earlier this month in front of Congress on the impacts of Title 42 and how to create an orderly asylum system. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start off by saying, by and large, even though this is implemented under a public health statute, this is an immigration policy. So speaking from an immigration point of view, Aaron, has this been effective?
Title 42 has been a failure. We know now, after 2 years of its use, that it is neither a meaningful public health measure nor a successful deterrent. And we saw that within months of the policy being put in place. By September of 2020, border encounters were at the highest level for a fall that they had been in 15 years. And in the months after Title 42 went into place, border apprehensions increased every single month for over a year. That's because Title 42 has massively increased repeat crossings and incentivizes people to cross the border over and over and over again. last month, 2 out of every 5 apprehensions by the Border Patrol was a person on their 2nd, 3rd, or 4th, or even higher attempt to cross the border, probably having been expelled under Title 42 every single time.
So we hear this number, I think it's 1.7 million expulsion incidents, but you're saying that it's not 1.7 million people. It's a repeat of the same thing happening over and over again in many cases.
That's right. And in fact, over the last 2 years, out of about 2.5 million border encounters, 882,000 over the last 18 months were repeat encounters of the same person on a 2nd or higher attempt to cross the border. And these repeat encounters really have two reasons. You know, first, facing desperation and insecurity in northern Mexico, even the most staunchly rule-bound asylum seekers can feel forced to cross the border repeatedly in search of safety rather than having to wait indefinitely for Title 42 to be lifted. And then for people who aren't seeking asylum, Title 42 carries no collateral consequences, such as a criminal prosecution or a deportation order. The most likely outcome of people crossing the border is an expulsion back to northern Mexico, where they can try again. And that's, of course, only if Title 42 applies to them. And at this point, barely more than half of the people coming to the border can even be subject to Title 42.
So you say a Title 42 is a failure. There are in Washington lawmakers, both Republicans and Democrats, who express concern about the fact that it is set to be lifted next month. Republicans have been very vocal against the Biden administration's decision to end Title 42. Here is Representative Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin.
If we repeal Title 42, which means more families and a lot more single people coming, that number could shoot up from 80,000 to 500,000. And that's the administration's own number. I don't know what our country's going to do if we begin to get as many as 500,000 people coming here every month.
And it's not just Republicans. Several Democrats have also voiced reservations, saying they want to see a comprehensive plan in place before the policy is lifted. There's a bipartisan bill seeking to delay the end of this policy. Democratic Senators Mark Kelly of Arizona and Mackie Hassan of New Hampshire are co-sponsors. So, Aaron, without this policy, we know that immigration law is difficult in the best of times. What sort of policy should be or should have been in place, in your opinion, to replace Title 42?
It's important to remember that we already have laws on the books to handle people crossing the border. Title 42 is barely 2 years old, and we have been managing people coming across the border for a century. And so when Title 42 goes away, what's going to likely happen, and the Biden administration has said it's going to do, is they're going to start increasing actual deportations, likely start sending more people back to Mexico under the Remain in Mexico program, and start criminally prosecuting people for crossing the border, which hasn't been happening for the past 2.5 years. And importantly, however, Title 42 is in some ways a distraction. We've spent the last 8 years trying increasingly draconian tactics to stop people from coming to the border, rather than do our homework as a nation and fix the known problems we have with our humanitarian protection system. President Obama tried family detention. President Trump tried family separation, then Remain in Mexico, then Title 42. And President Biden has kept Title 42 in place. If we had spent all of that time, money, and energy in actually building a workable humanitarian protection system that encouraged people to go to the ports of entry and apply for asylum, then we would be in a very different situation than we're in today. But right now, for the last 2 years, the ports of entry have been largely closed to asylum seekers. So the only way to seek asylum for the overwhelming majority of people coming to the border is to take one step across and ask the nearest Border Patrol agent.
Harold, if Title 42 is lifted as expected, what assurances are there in place that it won't be implemented again if we have a new surge of COVID or for another pandemic? Is there anything that can be done to ensure that the mistakes as you saw them, we learn from them and don't commit them again?
Well, the CDC changed its public health position and said it would no longer support this. I think they felt that they were being used as cover for this policy for which there wasn't a good public health rationale. And the CDC is supposed to play a scientific role, not a political role. So they would have to reinstate this based on some assessment that some public health risk has resumed. But I think the point that Aaron makes is a very important one, which is what President Biden said when he was running for president, which I think was absolutely right, is in America, you come to the board and you make your case. And so we ought to have a capacity at places like ports of entry for people to make their case for individualized asylum, which means increasing the number of people who are hearing these asylum claims and assessing the validity of those claims. Now, if they do that, not everybody's going to make asylum. And so it's really a question of administrative capacity in expanding that. If Congress wants to do something, they should legislate for more capacity in these immigration agencies.
And Monette, sort of a similar question to you. Are there new, I know there are procedures already in place, but are there new and innovative ways to try to deal with the issue of migration, especially when you have the sort of storm we had in 2020 where you had these disasters happening, human rights disasters, natural disasters, and a pandemic, so that the CDC has a better place to start next time?
So I think what's really important for the CDC and for public health generally is that the CDC reclaim a position whereby they are driven by the science and by the data. I think this whole Title 42 experience has been very damaging to the CDC's reputation and to the role that it should play in standing as a sort of neutral, science-based arbiter of what is important to protect the public health. So I hope that there will be lessons learned within the CDC, in terms of really following the science, following the data, and ensuring that in some way they are protected from these political pressures to provide a fig leaf for policies that have ulterior motives. But, you know, I think the other thing to bear in mind is, when the history is written, to understand that Title 42 and the wholesale closure of the border resulted in completely disproportionate harms to individuals, both the individuals who were expelled to face violence, but also, potentially in the medium and longer term, the suggestion that has been fed by this whole process that somehow migrants are vectors of disease. And I think that's a really worrying and troublesome theme in the whole Title 42 discourse that we just need to be very mindful of and somehow counter going forward. And finally, I think, remember, we have tried and tested public health tools to manage asylum seekers and migrants effectively at the border. I mean, it's really telling that a country like Poland has managed to screen and absorb and sort of adhere to its asylum obligations for 2 million Ukrainians at the same time, in the space of a very, very short few weeks, at the same time as the US has been saying, we don't have the capacity to do this. Of course, we have the capacity to do this. We have the public health tools to do this. I think what's really important is the political will to stand up for asylum and to stand up for a rules-based, rights-based approach at the border that incorporates public health.
Aaron, it's been more than a year that the Biden administration has had to address this. My colleague, Boston Globe columnist Marcela Garcia, wrote about the political conundrum that Democrats are saying they're facing. She writes, for Biden and the Democrats, the end of this disastrous policy should not be framed as a political headache, but as an opportunity to demonstrate that it is possible and suitable to process asylum applications in an orderly, legal, and humane way at the U.S.-Mexico border. She goes on to say that the United States must recognize that conditions on the ground in countries like, say, Haiti and Nicaragua, as well as the horrific ongoing war in Ukraine, compel us to offer asylum to migrants arriving from troubled places through the southern border. Can you talk about how the fact that immigration policy is in itself a political landmine, but at the same time, you are seeing some of the inconsistencies that Harold was talking about, some people from some places being let in, other people's pushed out. What should be at the top of the agenda for Democrats and Republicans right now?
I think Marcella is right. And right now, Democrats need to come out and talk about the honest challenges that are involved with these issues. We have to remember that migration doesn't happen in a vacuum. We can't talk about Title 42 without looking to countries like Ukraine and acknowledging that migrants are on the move around the world and not just to the United States. Since you cannot turn off migration with the push of a button, border management should never adopt a goal of zero migration. And simultaneously, we need to acknowledge that operational control of the border can and should include opportunities for desperate people to seek protection. Going forward, the Biden administration needs to come out and be crystal clear that, and not only about the challenges and costs of responding to migration, but also about the benefits that we receive as a nation from people who still view this country as a beacon of freedom. It's not like the Biden administration doesn't have any success record here. At the start of the administration, about 1 year ago today, there were 23,000 unaccompanied migrant children in government custody. Many of them were held for weeks, if not longer, because the system was completely overwhelmed. Today, even with nearly the same number of kids coming to the border, most are out of government custody into the hands of a loved one within 14 days, thanks to real progress the Biden administration has made in that system. And so the Biden administration could point to their prior successes, which I will note were not perfect. Of course, everything has teething troubles, and there are still concerns that remain. But they have a proven track record of ensuring that people don't get stuck in overcrowded Border Patrol cells. But what they can't do is continue to actually act as if they can simply turn off migration with a policy or make anything change in the short term, rather than without addressing the root causes of migration, which are why people are leaving their countries in the first place.
Harold, what do you think the legacy of this policy will be?
Well, I think you can't misuse public health authorities for immigration purposes. That should be the basic lesson. I mean, take a look at the lifting of mask mandates on airplanes or in states like Florida. What is having a bigger impact on public health? Is it that or spread of transmission among people who are already in the country, or is it people who are trying to get into the country? I think we have to have some sense of proportion about that. I think also, at the end of the day, I support the Biden administration. I think there are a lot of things they've done well. I work for them. I want them to succeed. I certainly prefer them to the alternative. But I don't think they should pursue failed policies, and I don't think they should pursue illegal policies. And this is a policy that's both illegal and failed. And therefore, I think Aaron's right. We have to start looking in different directions and figure out a way in which we respect asylum rights while taking valid public health considerations into account. And a more nuanced approach to that kind of thing should be what emerges from all of this history.
Aaron, in just the few seconds we have left, same question to you. What do you think the legacy of this policy will be?
Chaos, confusion, and thousands of people sent back to danger without making any of us safer in any way.
All right. Aaron Reichlin Melnick is a senior policy counsel at the American Immigration Council. Thank you so much for joining us. Monette Zard is the director of the Program on Forced Migration and Health at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Thanks to you, Monette.
Thank you.
And Harold Koh is a former senior advisor on the State Department's legal team in the Biden administration. Thank you so much, Harold.
Thank you, Kimberly.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.